Good morning to everyone. Certainly is good to be here and thankful for the presence of each and every one of you. I began a series the last time I had an opportunity to stand before you, and the series was on free will. And so this will be the second in that series, and there probably will be at least one more. I have plans for one more, at least, and I don't know when that may be. It may be a while, because, of course, we're anticipating Philip Mullins, a supported preacher, to come to us in just a few weeks. And so those of us who have been doing this for a while, myself and other men who have been doing a lot of the teaching and preaching, won't have as many opportunities to do that as we have had. So I want to say again, said this before, but I've really appreciated. You know, we've been without a preacher, a supported preacher, you know, for what, a year and 3 months, I think, something like that. And I haven't heard anybody say, these guys would get out of here, or, you know, these guys sure are bad at this. I wish we'd get a professional in here or something. Now, people may have said that, but they didn't hear it. They didn't say it in my hearing, at least. So, but I'm looking forward to Philip coming soon, and I think we're going to learn a lot from him. But I also appreciate the amount of, you know, time and effort that has gone into, you know, keeping the teaching and preaching going over the last year and 3 months. And so thank you again for this opportunity that I've had to do that. And I think that we've all grown from this process. Well, I'm certainly not the first one who has addressed the subject of free will, and won't be the last. However, my starting point was a little bit different than typical, because I was considering this. The subject is usually, especially in a church in this context, it's almost always, when you're talking about free will, you're almost always juxtaposing that free will with a Calvinistic bent of predestination, which, of course, predestination is a biblical word, but it means something to Calvinists that we do not believe that the Bible teaches. But rather than that, last time that I was up, we were considering it not from a theological point of view, but rather from more of a secular point of view, which is a bigger subject than I thought it was before I began to research and look at what people were saying about free will in the larger world. And so I talked about more of an exploration of current secular thinking as it relates to free will and the opposite of that, which is called determinism. So it's free will on one side and determinism on the other. Those are the two things, and I'll define that in just a moment. But they have those two ways of thinking have very different outcomes and implications for us as human beings. And I'll take just a minute to kind of catch us up if you weren't here last time, or maybe you might have forgotten some of the things that we talked about. So I'll take just a few minutes to kind of catch us up to where we were. This is my assessment a definition of free will, and this would probably be pretty close whether we're talking about a secular view of it or a Calvinistic view of it. Those two will be very similar. But the way that I have defined this, and the way it's typically defined, is this. Free will is, in this context, is described as individuals make their own choices through life with a sense and a reality of self-determination such that we human beings are completely responsible and accountable for our own actions and our own lives, our own choices, our own decisions. So that's the free will side. And determinism in this context, again, a more secular context is what we're talking about at the moment. Determinism in this secular context means that a person is led by physical and chemical mechanisms within their own brain, and that the controls of human life are solely imposed by the social constructs of the time and place and environment of their birth, so that we human beings, along with every other creature, are basically running, if you were to compare it to a computer, we are running a software program from our birth to our death. So we are essentially sort of like moist computers. We're moist robots. So we're running software from birth to death, and the behavior of our lives is the result then of a long line of prior causes that began at the break of the cosmic pool table of random collisions starting with the Big Bang. Now, if you've never played pool, that may not mean anything to you. But for those of us who have played pool in the times past, you know that when you take your cue ball and your stick and you break this little triangle of balls, the balls just sort of go everywhere, right? And I'm sure most of us have done that at one time or another. So they seem to be random, and they are to some degree. Some fall in certain pockets, and most of them just sort of bounce around different places till they all stop. And that's your table. That's the table that you're playing on. So this is the sort of a comparison of what we are as human beings, and I've heard that illustration made. And so Richard Dawkins says we dance to our own DNA, and that's the way he puts that whole scenario. So, and if you are a strict materialist or naturalist, as is sometimes referred to, that makes perfect sense. That's the thing that we should recognize, is that we may think that this is ridiculous. However, if it's your view that everything is random, that makes perfect sense for our lives to be completely the same way, because a universe of random processes can't then produce something outside of random processes, like a human being that has free will, who is responsible and accountable for their own actions. So, I was born this way can be an excuse for any kind of bad behavior. Don't blame me. I was born this way. And we hear that, you know, quite often in various contexts. Now, after my last lesson, I had several come up to me with some thoughts about it. And I'm obviously always happy to hear what people have to say about these things. But Michael Williams, I was hoping he might be here, because he had a few things to say about it, because he deals with sort of the counseling aspect of, and there are some philosophies that are behind some of counseling techniques that he's very familiar with. And on a practical basis, he's in it regularly. But he told me that the belief, now we're talking about like 12-step programs, counseling people with addictions of various sorts, and that kind of thing is what Michael does on a regular basis. But he was telling me, and this related to some of the things that I said, that the belief in a higher power is in these realms of counseling, it is a coping mechanism, I believe is the way he put it. In other words, there's a lot of other coping mechanisms and tools that people might use in order to get out of bad behavior and not have the addictions that are harmful to them and other people around them. So to believe in a higher power, and that's usually the way they put it, doesn't have to be Jehovah God, Jesus, the Trinity. It could be anything. It could be a cosmic force. It doesn't really, the identity of the higher power is kind of irrelevant. But to believe in one is kind of a coping mechanism that might help individuals, because if there is an existence of an ultimate lawgiver, an ultimate judge, that is useful to control people's bad habits. But the reality of God's existence is kind of irrelevant. And I, in my research on this and from a secular perspective, saw that over and over again, that the idea of there being a God was useful to mankind to control his bad behavior. But we scientists don't actually believe it's true. But it's in practical terms, it's useful to control human beings. That is their perspective on it, a large part of the time. So it's a concept to them that people can cope with life if they believe there's something grander going on here. It's a coping mechanism, and that's all, essentially. So that was some of the things that Michael said, and I appreciated that. Also, Elaine Metcalf gave me an article, or sent me an article, emailed it to me, that she had just read, and I thought, and it was right down the line of what I had preached about. This is from Terry Wayne Benton, who was a preacher down in Columbia, South Carolina. And I won't read all of this, but the name of the article is Morality from Molecules. Morality from Molecules with a question mark. And I'll just read a few lines from this and you'll kind of get the gist of what he's getting at, which was very close to what I was talking about last time. He says this: if morality is just preference, then no one should be punished for anything. Nothing can really be right and nothing can be wrong. It is all a matter of how your molecules are arranged in your mind. Nothing can actually ever be your fault. See, that's exactly what I was saying. So I'm glad to be sort of, confirmed on this from someone else, because I didn't read any of our brethren's literature or anything like that as a starting point for myself. But he goes on here. He says, we could not judge right and wrong except for a standard that is more authoritative than our own opinions and desires. Molecules cannot account for all of us using such words as should not, ought not. We all feel that we should do better, and we should not have said and done things. The atheist squirms to come up with an answer, but his premise means that he cannot assert that anything is right or wrong, good or evil. He must try to deny it, but he can't. Therefore, there is something built into us that gives us that sense of ought, but mere molecules did not build it into us. God built it into us. Moral ought is in us from the higher moral being who made us. So I thought that was pretty good. And again, right along with what I was saying last time, I realized that some of my sermons are a little bit off-center from the norms. I mean, I did do four lessons, I believe, on the vestibular system that nobody even ever heard of. So, but I'm glad to, you know, because I do that kind of thing, I'm glad to have another brother in Christ. You know, a preacher actually confirmed something that I had been thinking for a while. And this brings us kind of to where we left off last time. There will be no end to the vain philosophies of men and science, falsely so called, while the earth stands. There will be no end to this. So don't expect it. Don't expect people to start understanding what you understand. I don't see it coming. In fact, I see it getting worse. But Paul said in Colossians 2:8, he says, "Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ. For in him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily, and you are complete in him, who is the head of all principality and powers." So, one of the reasons that I wanted to present this line of thinking and talk about this subject is because I don't want any of us to be cheated through the vain philosophies and empty deceit that are according to the principles of the world and not according to Christ. Because if you know what the deceit is, you're less likely to be deceived by it. If you know there's a deception going on, you can see it when you hear it and know that that's what's going on. So Paul said that there would be people who would be always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Ever learning, but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Doesn't that describe so much of our culture right now? Ever learning, always learning stuff, but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. That is so descriptive of so much of the psychobabble side of the world that goes on all the time, where people are trying to explain things that they don't know the underpinning or the foundation of because they have rejected the belief in the founder of the world, God. And because of that, all their other conclusions are wrong. They're ever learning, but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Later in chapter 4 there, that was 2 Timothy 3:7, by the way. And in chapter 4, he says, "For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to" what? Fables. Fables. We are living in such a time as this. Much of the world today, across continents, across nations, are living their lives according to fables. That is so true. That is exactly right. They are living according to fables and not according to the truth. And the apostles, incidentally, you know, when the apostles are writing these things, when the apostles talk about fables, they know what fables are. They had fables. The Jewish customs had all kinds of fables going on. Probably some of you have heard of creation fables and lots of other fables. That's why Peter said, you know, that we don't follow cunningly devised fables when we've made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but what? We were eyewitnesses of his glory. We're eyewitnesses. This is not about fables for us. We know what fables are, and this isn't it. This is truth. This is real. We were eyewitnesses to his glory. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Solomon said that, what, some 3,000 or so years ago? And it's as true today as it was then. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. It does not change. It never changes. It's as true today as it was 3,000 years ago when Solomon spoke it. I want to take the next few minutes, it won't take real long, to dispel the foolishness of man with the wisdom and knowledge of God. We have free will because God has free will. God chose to create this universe. He chose to put the sun, moon, and stars in place so that we could know him. And he made us in his image and likeness. And a part of that picture is we have free will like God has free will. He chooses what he wants to do. And part of what he wanted to do was make us. And so we have free will. The easy answer, the simple answer, the cut to the chase answer is we have free will because God does, and he made us in his image. That's the simple, clear answer. Now, we'll prove that in the coming verses. We'll take a sort of a quick tour through the Bible, both Old and New Testament, but not a lot, not exhaustive, because we don't have to be exhaustive. It's pretty easy. And my next lesson, whenever that comes in the future, will relate to what a great advantage it is for us to clearly understand and affirm that we as human beings have personal autonomy, that we have that free will. I don't remember anybody, maybe it's just something that we're supposed to assume, but I don't remember it being told to me in that way, though, when I was a child, that we actually have free will in this way, that you actually choose your destiny. You choose whether you're going to heaven. And I'm really convinced that most people out here in the world, they think that there's something automatic about this that they really don't have any choice in. There's just something, well, if you're good enough and you go to heaven, if you've been bad, it's kind of like Santa Claus. I mean, it's just, you know, he knows whether you've been good or bad, and if you've been good, you go to heaven. If you've been bad, you go to hell. You don't have, you know, it's just something that happens. I wish that this was clearer in people's minds, and that's what I'll talk about next time. But for now, God speaks to Cain after Cain killed Abel, or I think it was actually just before. And this is a very important verse. Yeah, it was before because God talked to Cain because he was not he was downcast because that God did not accept his sacrifice like he did Abel's. And here's what God said to Cain in Genesis 4, 6, and 7. He said, "So the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it.'" Some versions say, "You must rule over it." Well, now, what if Cain said after he had killed Abel, he said, it's not my fault. Am I my brother's keeper? God made me this way. He made me. I was unfortunate enough to get a murderer's brain. Therefore, I killed my brother Abel because God made me do it, or my brain made me do it, or I was, emotional. That's the way I felt at the time. It's not my fault. Did Cain have to kill his brother Abel? No, of course not. That's ridiculous. He didn't, but he did not rule over sin. And that's what happens when we walk by the flesh and not by the Spirit. We do things the flesh wants to do rather than what the Spirit tells us that we should do and ought to do. Here's another one. Exodus 32:26. When Moses had come down from Mount Sinai, you remember that the children of Israel had made a golden calf, and they were all dancing around it and worshiping it. And Moses beheld this scene, and what did he say? He said, whoever is on the Lord's side, come to me. And certain ones did. They were the sons of Levi, gathered themselves together to Moses. Now, Moses was giving a fork in the road there. He was giving an up or down vote, a left or right, a yea or nay. Jesus said, let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. And that is the choice that Moses was presenting to the children of Israel when he saw them worshiping this idol that was made like the idols of Egypt. And he said, whoso is on the Lord's side, let him come stand with me. Is that a choice? Yes. You could not get clearer than that. If you're on the Lord's side, you come and stand with me. I'm on the Lord's side. Come and stand with me if you're on the Lord's side. And the sons of Levi did, but the rest of them didn't. They were standing with the golden calf side, apparently. Here's another from Moses. Deuteronomy 30. This is very familiar, as most of these are, very familiar text to us. Deuteronomy 30, 15 through 19. Listen to this. See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil, in that I command you this day to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his commandments, his statutes, and his judgments, that you may live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go to possess. But if your heart turns away so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not prolong your days in the land which you go to cross over to possess. Now listen to this last, how he concludes this section of Scripture. In Deuteronomy 30, he says, I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, what? Choose life. Choose life. That both you and your descendants may live. Now, you would have to have help to misunderstand that, wouldn't you? You would have to have help. Because is there any way for God to say it more clearly than that? I don't think so. I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life. Now, secular determinist or religious Calvinist alike are being slapped in the face with a verse like that. God is saying, snap out of it. Stop believing things which are not true. You and only you are the one that chooses your eternal destiny, depending on whether you are self-willed or you have God's will in mind. That's what makes the differentiation. Whether you are self-willed or it is God's will that you are most interested in. Well, we've heard from God to speaking to Cain. We've heard from Moses to Israel. How about Joshua? Joshua 24, another familiar passage to us, 14 to 15. Now, therefore, fear the Lord, serve him with sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your father served on the other side of the river in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourself this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But what does Joshua say? As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Here's your choices, guys. You can serve those gods of the Amorites. You can serve those gods on the other side of the river. I don't care what you do. He didn't say that. But this is what he's saying. I know what I'm going to do. As for me and my house, we are going to serve the Lord. We will serve the Lord. Joshua 24. This is a precious gift to us. This is a precious gift being given by God to us, of having personal autonomy, a conscious agency, free will, that you can pass on to your house, by the way. Fathers and mothers, you can pass this precious gift to your household, to your family. How about Elijah? 1 Kings 18, 21. How long, of course, you remember that they were on Mount Carmel. It was a competition between the Baal and Jehovah, God. How long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. Again, two clear choices here. Follow Baal or follow the Lord. You need to make a decision here. You need to make some choices here. Here's the evidence. The Lord is the one who brought the fire down and licked up the altar and the water and the sacrifice and the water and the trench around it. Which one are you going to serve? Seems pretty plain, doesn't it? What about Isaiah? Isaiah 1, wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, put away the evil of your doings from before my eyes, cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, rebuke the oppressor, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow, come now and let us reason together, saith the Lord. What good are any commands in the Bible if we have no ability to keep them? What good are any of these commands if we can't choose to obey them? They're no good whatsoever. If we don't have free will, we cannot have a relationship with God. And furthermore, we couldn't even have relationships with other people if we don't have free will. None of it makes any sense without free will. Now, those were all Old Testament examples. Now, let's look at a few in the New Testament and we'll be done. How about Jesus? Well, the whole New Testament teaching, the gospel message, salvation itself, all has the assumption, there's the assumption, there's the presupposition behind it that we have free will. Otherwise, nothing Jesus says makes any sense. Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest, he says. How often, he says to Israel, how often would I have gathered you together as a hen doth gather her brood under her wings, and what you would not. We will not have this man to rule over us. That was the attitude of most of Israel. We will not have this man to rule over us. I wanted to gather you together, protect you, save you, provide for you. You wouldn't have it. You would not have me. I wanted you. You wouldn't have me. There it is again. None of this makes any sense unless we have free will. Peter says in Acts 2, save yourselves from this perverse generation. Well, how can we do that, Peter? We don't have free will. We're just floating along here like leaves in a river. We can't do, what do you mean? You mean there's something we can do? Yes, there's something you can do. You can save yourselves from this perverse generation by obeying the Lord. That's what you can do. That's the message of the Bible. It's the message of the Old Testament. It's the message of the New Testament under Christ. Exercise your free will and follow me, Jesus. That's what Jesus is saying. That's what God is saying from the very beginning. Exercise your free will to follow me and not the vain philosophies of this world, not science falsely so called of this world. And that's what you can do today. That's why we offer nearly every time that we get together, we offer an invitation, because the Bible itself is an appeal to our will. That's really what it is. God is appealing to our will. Now, he uses different ways to appeal to that in the Bible as far as the literature of the Bible. But ultimately, at the ground level, when you boil it all down, at the core, at the center, the Bible is appealing to our will. It's laying out the history of God's redemption of man from the beginning to the end and say, this is what it is. Now you decide whether you're going to follow me or follow your own desires. And my recommendation is to follow the Lord. Be like Joshua. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And you can do that this morning. That's our sermon for today. If we can help you, if I can help you in any way, come closer to the Lord, even being baptized into his name this morning, then all things are ready as far as I know. And you can do that as together we stand and sing the chosen song.